You're listening to a podcast hosted by Med Learning Group.
Hello, and welcome to this podcast, Detect, From Awareness to Action, Driving Multidisciplinary Application of Screening and Disease-Modifying Therapies in Early Stage T1D. We are nearing the end of our ongoing series, and in this sixth installment, we are speaking with two experts in the diagnosis and management of T1D. Dr. Roshanik Manzavi is a clinical professor of pediatrics at the Center for Endocrinology, Diabetes, and Metabolism at Children's Hospital Los Angeles. She is also director of the Pediatric Endocrinology Fellowship Program. Dr. Chuck Vega is a clinical professor of family medicine at the University of California, Irvine School of Medicine. He is also director of the UC Irvine Program in Medical Education for the Latino Community. Both Dr. Manzavi and Dr. Vega treat patients with diabetes as well as train other physicians on diabetic care and management. Today, they are joining to offer insights on how T1D screening and the treatment of pre-symptomatic T1D can be implemented in a busy practice. Doctors, thank you for joining and welcome to our podcast.
Great to be here. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having us.
Great. So let's get started. So I mentioned in the intro that we're on the sixth episode of our podcast series. And in every single episode prior to this one, we've discussed screening, the who, what, and where, and why of screening. But I'd like to ask you both about the how, the mechanics and the logistics of screening, if we can. How can clinicians incorporate screening as part of routine practice, and how can they effectively manage what comes after screening? Dr. Vega, why don't you start us off?
Right. Well, I appreciate the opportunity to answer this question because I think the part about, you know, how to do screening is really important for primary care clinicians like myself to understand. I think it starts with some basic knowledge of epidemiology and just being how we are not always doing a great job in terms of detecting type 1 diabetes. We have still far too many patients who are presenting to the emergency room in extremis and at risk for serious outcomes, negative outcomes, even mortality, by not screening and not keeping this more front of mind. So about 64,000 patients are diagnosed with type 1 diabetes annually in the United States. So it's not a problem that is that, you know, we're never going to see, or it's going to be once in a career. And I think another thing that we often think about type 1 diabetes being diagnosed during childhood and adolescence. And it is true that the incidence is higher in that age group, but actually most of the new diagnoses, just because there's such a preponderance of adults compared with children and adolescents. So most of the diagnoses happen after age 20 years. So what it really comes down to me is just being aware and looking for risk factors, putting together clues from the patient's history. So looking at their family history is certainly important, thinking about type 1 diabetes, but maybe they have a series of illnesses either personally or even in their family, autoimmune thyroid disorders, celiac disease, vitiligo. All of these are associated with a higher risk of type 1 diabetes as well. And I don't think there's a certain point necessarily where I would take a look at somebody's risk factors. I think it's very clear when they have a first degree relative with type 1 diabetes, I'm going to, you know, talk to them about screening right away. But say if it's an aunt with Hashimoto's thyroiditis and they think that somebody has diabetes in their family, but they never were clear whether it's type 2 or type 1 first, they can call that individual and reach out and try to find so we can better try to assess their risk. I think that's really important. But I tend to, when I'm in a little bit of doubt, I think about testing. Another scenario where I will be more likely than not to initiate testing is when all that type 2 diabetes that you see in my practice, because I see a lot, just does not act like type 2 diabetes. It's more aggressive. The patients don't necessarily fit a phenotype. Their triglyceride levels are normal. They have a healthy weight or even underweight, and you know, there's no family history of type 2 diabetes. All those things make me think. And then we initiate treatment. Lo and behold, the usual drugs are not working for them. The A1C is not coming down. They're still having severe hyperglycemia. That's when I would initiate testing. In terms of how, it's those four islet antibodies. So really looking at, is the glutamic acid decarboxylase-65 or GAD65, islet antigen 2 or IA2, the zinc co-transporter 8 or ZNT8, and then insulin antibodies. So I try to get, I get all four. When I have developed a rationale for why I need this, because of the family history, because of risk factors, I've honestly, even in my safety net clinic, really have had only a handful of cases where I've had a hard time getting them covered. And this is almost always through Medicaid or Medicare insurance. And then we move forward from there. But I find that those just having a lower threshold, I have detected, as a matter of fact, more cases of type 1 diabetes at stages well before the patient's going to present with clinical symptoms.
Yeah, I want to completely agree with what Dr. Vega was just discussing right now. We know that type 1 diabetes is a lot more prevalent than we think about. About 1 in 300 people get type 1 diabetes through the course of their lifetime. So it's a lot more prevalent than we may realize. And going to what you mentioned, Dr. Vega, about the family history, that's also very important. We know that first-degree relatives with people with type 1 diabetes have a risk of 1 in 20 or 5%. So the risk is 15 times higher. So definitely, I think it's very important as physicians for us to think about screening in people. Definitely, we should think about screening in people with family history. With that said, most people who get type 1 diabetes do not have a family history of type 1 diabetes. So we don't want to ignore people who don't have a family history, and we need to kind of have that in our radar. The four antibodies that you mentioned are definitely the correct ones to do. And we can, as a physician, one can order those commercially. There's also some research programs that people can participate in. There is an NIDDK-sponsored research program called TrialNet that's been going on since 2001, screening so far, you know, tens of thousands of family members of people with type 1 diabetes to check for the risk factors. If someone doesn't have any family history, they can register through another research program called the ASK research program through the Barbara Davis Diabetes Center. So those are some research opportunities where it would be completely free for families to get tested and potentially also participate in prevention trials later on. But as Chuck also mentioned, these antibodies can also be ordered commercially and hopefully be covered by the insurance company.
All good information from both of you. Thank you. Dr. Manzavi, on to you. In most cases, once a patient has been diagnosed with clinical diabetes or stage 3 T1D, an endocrinologist or diabetologist becomes involved in the care and management of that patient. Pre-symptomatic T1D, though, it's a little bit different, right? For example, insulin treatment is not needed at that point, and especially for those who have been screened and test positive for two autoantibodies, it's a time-sensitive period, if you will. The clock is ticking, as they say. So with all of this in mind, what are some strategies that both primary care and diabetes specialists can utilize to try to coordinate care for these patients?
That's an excellent question. And just for viewers who might have not listened to the other podcast episodes, I want to talk about the different stages of diabetes. So when we talk about someone who has clinical diabetes, who's already having high blood sugars, now we call that stage 3 type 1 diabetes. So you have the antibodies present and your blood sugars are already very elevated. But we know that this process starts from months to years prior. And so someone has genetic predisposition, then some environmental trigger starts the autoimmune process in their body that starts destroying the beta cells that make insulin. So the first thing that we could see is these antibodies that we talked about, positive antibodies with completely normal blood sugars. We call that stage 1 diabetes because we now know that people who are at stage 1 type 1 diabetes have a very, very high chance of developing stage 3 over their lifetime. Stage 2 diabetes would be when you're having the positive antibodies and your glucoses are starting to become abnormal, or what we call in the pre-diabetes range. So as physicians start screening people for antibodies for diabetes, they will identify individuals who have stage 1 and stage 2 diabetes who don't have the clinical stage 3 yet. The best thing that they can do is obviously they can contact a specialist like an endocrinologist right away, but I think what's really important is to figure out, is this person in stage one or stage two, or maybe already in stage three? So the next thing after doing antibodies that would be great to do is by measuring a hemoglobin A1C to see what the person's overall glucose control has been over the past couple of months, and also do what we call a glucose tolerance test to see where the glucose ranges are. Are they completely normal in the prediabetes range or in the diabetes range? So once we do that, or the physician does that, they can kind of figure out, is this person stage one, stage two, or stage three? Stage three diabetes, which means clinical diagnosis, obviously is a very urgent referral, an urgent call to a specialist in the area for the patient to be seen within a couple of days, because they already have clinical diabetes and they need to get insulin right away. Otherwise, they can become dehydrated and have DKA. If someone has stage two diabetes, we know that the risk of getting to stage three is pretty high. It's about 60% risk in the next 2 years and 85% risk in the next 5 years. So that would be a rather semi-urgent referral to a pediatric endocrinologist or an adult endocrinologist. And I would say definitely by the time someone's in stage two, they should start seeing a specialist so they can be monitored much closer. If someone is in stage one, which means their blood sugars are still completely normal, but they have positive antibodies, the risk is a little bit farther down the line. So the five-year risk is about 30 to 50%, and the 15-year risk is about 85%. So maybe not as urgent of a referral, but definitely it could warrant a referral for the family to have that discussion with the pediatric or adult endocrinologist about the implications for the future. We also know the younger you are when the antibodies show up, the faster this progression is, and the more antibodies you have, the faster this progression is. And those are the nuances that the specialist can discuss with a family and discuss how closely they need to be monitored.
Yeah, from my perspective, I do think it's really incumbent upon PCPs to initiate that antibody screening. You don't want to lose that opportunity. And most of the patients I screen are negative. So there, you can be faced with a quandary. If it's a high-risk patient, there are protocols for rescreening, particularly children. Especially younger children are going to need more frequent screening. I usually would like to involve a pediatric endocrinologist in that effort, just to keep patients on track and remind them of what to look for. Sometimes you're speaking the same message as our specialist colleagues, but it's good to have that support, because oftentimes I'm doing the well child visits. I'm talking about vaccinations. We're doing their, you know, all of their developmental milestones. It's oftentimes a lot. So it's nice to get some help on this, because it does vary based on case to case. I think it's also really important, in case we do get a positive result, one, we should refer, as was mentioned. Great job, Dr. Manzavi. But also, we also should be repeating those tests to make sure that they are, because there are false positives, and ordering the A1C along with oral glucose tolerance testing if we can do that, because that's going to give the endocrinologist the full range of information they need. Yes, we've verified there's a positive antibody, whether it's 1 through 4 number of antibodies, and we know what stage they're in thanks to the glucose testing. And I think that in terms of some of the, you know, maybe when there's a question about, like, gosh, just one antibody is positive, what's our follow-up for this? That's where endocrinology can be particularly helpful, because it's hard to, you know, it does get a little bit tricky with the algorithms as you start to go through individual case scenarios. So it's nice to have a wing person on board, like Dr. Manzavi, who can help really make it clear for patients and their supporters.
Yeah, I agree with that 100%. Another thing that I think we both probably were thinking and we haven't mentioned yet is discussing with families what symptoms of clinical diabetes are. So once you have those antibodies and you know you're on that trajectory of heading toward stage three, whether it's going to happen for you in a month or in 20 years, it's good for you to know the symptoms. So as soon as you have symptoms of diabetes, you reach out to your family practice or pediatrician or internal medicine doctor, or to the specialist that you've already seen, and say, I'm already having the symptoms now, and then you will be urgently evaluated.
All good information and tips. What I'm hearing is screen, rescreen, educate the patients all throughout the process, and know when to refer. What about those patients who have tested positive for two or more autoantibodies. They're not symptomatic, so they're in that stage two T1D, that critical time period. What about trying to delay progression to stage three, to clinical diabetes? There is teplizumab that is now available. So for those patients who are eligible for teplizumab, what are some things clinicians can do and keep in mind before recommending that treatment for these patients?
Excellent question, Mel. And I have to say, this is a really, really exciting time to be a diabetologist, because for decades now, we have been doing research to try to see if there is any medication that can change the trajectory of this autoimmune process. And there have been some medications that seem to be fairly successful or partially successful, and some that have not. One medication that has shown some promise is called teplizumab, which is an immune modulator. And a few studies have looked at teplizumab. A main one that was quite exciting was Trutron, that actually looking at people with stage 2 diabetes getting a 14-day course of teplizumab, and it showed that it could delay the progression to stage 3 by about 2 years. Based on this, the FDA has now approved teplizumab as a treatment to delay type 1 diabetes. And I think this then goes back to what we've been trying to highlight here, the importance of screening and identifying those individuals who may be in stage 2 diabetes. So if a physician has screened a patient and they have found that they have antibodies, and if they have done an A1C or glucose tolerance test and they have seen that the patient has stage 2 diabetes, they are definitely a candidate for this. And a referral to a specialist would then definitely be warranted. Teplizumab is a 14-day infusion. It's a daily infusion that's done over 14 days. It does have a lot of benefits and it does have some side effects. So at this point, it is mainly done in larger centers under the supervision of specialists. There have been guidelines now that have been published through the Pediatric Endocrine Society, for example, that kind of spells out the things that we as physicians need to think about when we do teplizumab infusions at our centers. So it is definitely an option. And I would say definitely referring to an adult or pediatric endocrinology center that is experienced in doing teplizumab infusions for your patients to have that option.
Yeah, I think teplizumab is a huge step forward, the first real disease modifying therapy for type 1 diabetes. And you're helping to prolong time off insulin, you're preventing organ damage, you know, such a critical time, really any time of life, right? Because, you know, think about it in kids, and I think about, you know, that the time that they have to be socialized and develop and, you know, and having, you know, not having to use insulin and I think is, you know, is really, you know, it's a good advantage to have. But even in adulthood too, you know, type 1 diabetes demands a lot of attention, demands rigor. And, you know, the folks who live with it, goodness, they can really develop some habits in terms of organization that I find outstanding personally. But if, you know, there has been research looking at teplizumab among folks with type 1 diabetes and what their attitudes are, and yes, they would say that absolutely, you know, the potential to avoid the onset of symptomatic diabetes for 2 years would be something they would very much value and very much worth the 2 week infusion for. I do get concerned about the application where this drug is really needed, and thinking about health equity. I think that teplizumab, because it's in more specialized centers, at least it certainly started out that way. It's now diffusing more into community sites. So it's definitely been more for folks with better access to healthcare, better resources. But I would also say that it's really important to consider for low-income populations like the ones that I see, because they, once they developed symptomatic type 1 diabetes, they don't have the same access to specialists. They don't have the same access to technology, which has really been another huge advance for folks with type 1 diabetes, thinking about the use of continuous glucose monitoring and insulin pumps and just how they can interact. It's really quite incredible. But that's not where, unfortunately, a lot of my patients are. So I think as we move forward, forward, really want to think about who would might most benefit from teplizumab and try to expand its application more broadly. And so hopefully by recognizing more patients at an earlier stage, which is another barrier for particularly our patients who don't have the best access to care, I think that it's really important for those who are listening to this to take that message and internalize it so they can really try to get screening done for all who need it and apply teplizumab as well, be advocates for their patients as well, so they get this potential game changer of a treatment.
This concludes another episode of our podcast series on T1D. I would like to once again thank Dr. Roshanik Monzavi and Dr. Chuck Vega for participating, and thank you for listening. Thanks also goes to our supporter Sanofi US, who provided an educational grant for the CME CE activity. This podcast was brought to you by MedLearning Group. In support of improving patient care, MedLearning Group is jointly accredited by the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education, the Accreditation Council for Pharmacy Education, and the American Nurses Credentialing Center to provide continuing education for the healthcare team. Please join us for another episode of this podcast series on T1D. For more podcasts and other accredited activities, please visit us online at www.medlearninggroup.com.